From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a public health initiative to prevent teenage violence. We talk with Deborah Prothro-Stiff. She's considered the first person to say we should treat violence as a public health issue. It's something she started thinking about as a young doctor in a Boston emergency room. Also today, Gloria Wade Gales remembers growing up African-American in the segregated South. She says her family may not have had power, but they understood their strength. In those days, she says, children didn't have to chant, "I am somebody." Their family and teachers made sure they knew it. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews George Clinton's new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Energy Department released new information today about secret nuclear weapons tests and radiation tests conducted on human beings. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary said she was appalled, shocked, and deeply saddened to learn that the government conducted about 800 radiation tests on humans, some of whom were unaware of the risks. In one example, 18 civilians were injected with highly radioactive plutonium in the 1940s to determine what the safe exposures would be for atomic workers. The department also said it conducted 204 more underground nuclear tests between 1963 and 1990 at its Nevada test range than previously had been announced. With UN efforts to restore democracy in Haiti at an impasse, the Clinton administration is placing its hope in a new initiative. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Prime Minister Malval of Haiti has proposed a conference for all segments of Haitian society. The aim, to forge consensus among the military, which seized power in a coup 2 years ago, the business community, and supporters of Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who's in exile. President Clinton has endorsed the all-party conference. Lawrence Pezzullo is the administration's special advisor on Haiti.
The need now is to build a political force sufficient to ensure that the new government that will be formed under Aristide, naturally, he will be the president, will have sufficient support to be able to survive.
U.S. officials hope the pressure of economic sanctions will force Haiti's reluctant military leaders to go along with a new initiative. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The United Mine Workers and several of the nation's major coal companies have reached an agreement, which may end a six-month strike that affected seven states. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
More than 17,000 miners had suspended their pickets for 2 weeks in anticipation of a settlement, but the details of the five-year contract took that long to hammer out. Those details will not be released until the rank and file have a chance to look them over and vote on the contract. Both the union and the Bituminous Coal Operators Association credited special mediator and former cabinet official William Ussery with bringing them back to negotiations after both sides had charged one another with unfair practices. The dispute arose over the union's demand for job security and management's desire for flexibility in hiring. United Mine Workers representatives are saying they've won future employment for their members who may have been shut out of jobs at newly opened mines. Coal companies have expressed a desire to recapture the marketplace momentum that was lost during the strike. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points to close at a record 3,719. This is NPR. Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders has issued a statement stressing that her comments on the legalization of drugs are her personal opinions and not those of the Clinton administration. In a speech today, Elders said legalization of drugs would probably reduce the crime rate and should be studied as a way to reduce violence. That sparked an angry response from conservatives who called on President Clinton to demand Elders' resignation. The White House responded quickly to say that the president is against legalizing drugs. A successor has emerged in the Ivory Coast following the death of the West African country's longtime ruler. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Henri Konan Bedie, the Speaker of Ivory Coast Parliament, has apparently taken over as the West African country's new head of state. Konan Bedie, a former cabinet member and an ambassador to the United States, succeeds President Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who died earlier today after a long illness. Lufuet Boigny, believed to be nearly 100 years old, led the Ivory Coast to independence from France 33 years ago. He was Africa's longest-serving head of state. He spent much of the past year in France and Switzerland being treated for prostate cancer. In his absence, speculation increased over who would succeed Lufuet Boigny. Under the Constitution, Konan Bedie will serve out the last 2 years of Lufuet Boigny's 5-year term. But his succession is being initially disputed by Prime Minister Alassane Ouattara and political opposition leaders. They argue that the constitutional provision enabling Bedie to succeed is illegal. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour are preparing for another session of work on the Hubble Space Telescope. NASA officials say that 3 lengthy spacewalks have completed repairs to about half the telescope's focusing problems. Tonight, astronauts will install a corrective device that's designed to compensate for more of the instrument's remaining flaws. NASA engineers say it'll take 6 to 8 weeks before it's known whether the repairs have been successful. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders has said that violence in America is an epidemic. It's one of the leading causes of death and injury for our young people. The Centers for Disease Control is now treating violence as a public health problem. My guest, Deborah Prothro-Stiff, is considered the first person to insist that violence is a public health issue. She's an assistant dean at the Harvard School of Public Health and was one of the first women to serve as commissioner of public health for the state of Massachusetts. She also developed the first violence prevention curriculum for schools. She started thinking of violence as a public health issue 15 years ago when she was a resident at Boston City Hospital working in the emergency room.
Well, one night, about 3 in the morning, actually, a young man, after I had stitched him up, told me not to go to bed because he was going to go out and cut up the guy who had cut him, send the guy into the emergency room, and I was going to have to do some more stitching. What really struck me with that comment, and he almost said it as a joke, and we all kind of chuckled as he left, but immediately I was struck with how little responsibility my profession had taken for the problem of violence, in particular the prevention. For instance, if he had made a suicide attempt by ingesting pills and I had cleaned out his stomach and then he said, even as a joke, don't go to bed because I'm going to go home and I'm going to take some more pills, I would have had to respond very differently. That would have been an obligation of mine. And I was just struck immediately as to how we treated this problem of violence against others very differently. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that we have a responsibility to do more than stitch people up and send them out or treat them and street them, as some emergency departments are fond of saying.
Well, what can doctors possibly do to help prevent violence?
Well, one of the things that that I started doing was just studying the problem, and that taught me a considerable amount about the problem, which surprised me, actually. For instance, I was surprised to learn that half of the homicides occurred among friends and family who get into an argument. So I realized that our problem is a problem of handling anger and getting along, not just a stranger bad guy violence. I realized that we had a homicide rate that was so much higher than other countries, 10, 15, 20, even 70 times higher than other countries. And I realized that this was a preventable problem, that we didn't have to have this problem. So I thought that physicians and public health practitioners could help prevent violence, just as we had dealt with issues of smoking prevention, drunk driving prevention. We have been involved in attitudes and behavior changes to prevent illness. And it seems to me, and that's what got me started, that those same strategies that we had used around attitudes and behaviors could be helpful around this issue of violence prevention.
Do you still work in the emergency room?
No, I don't. I have one clinic an evening in one of the health centers in Boston, which is a teen clinic where I am one of the primary care physicians there.
Let's look at the emergency room, which is where you first started to get the idea of violence as a public health issue. What can doctors in an emergency room do to prevent violence?
Well, I use the depression and suicide response and prevention model to offer suggestions. At this point, people are developing protocols for emergency departments, which are in some ways modeled after what we do when someone is depressed or has made a suicide attempt. It involves assessing the urgency, in the case of violence, of their intent on revenge. It involves assessing their risk for subsequent episodes of violence. It often involves a referral to a psychiatric nurse or other emergency department mental health professional who can talk through some of those issues and assess whether that person even needs to be hospitalized. The pink slip, which is used to confine involuntarily those patients at risk for suicide, actually says says on the sheet, this person is a threat to himself or others. So it's a part, actually, of what's available, but just not used. It seems that from the emergency department, when children, particularly teenagers, are stitched up, we can offer, especially when they come to get their stitches taken out, some violence prevention counseling and education. And there's one program at Boston City Hospital where those patients are being identified, and a team is responding to their needs. The team includes a social worker, a psychologist, a violence prevention counselor, the nurse, and the physician. And this is applied mainly when children are admitted or teenagers are admitted because of violence, but also could be a part of the emergency room and follow-up experience.
Well, the idea of a physician at a hospital keeping a patient hospitalized because they think that they might be a danger to others, wouldn't that raise civil liberties issues? Couldn't somebody say, I'm being held against my will, and you're violating my civil liberties by doing that? I mean, how does any doctor know that I'm going to go out and seek revenge?
Well, the pink slip is a legal document that allows us to hold people against their will if they are a threat to themselves or a threat to others. It is difficult to assess the threat to others, and I think the intent of doing that kind of assessment would not be to hold the person against their will. A lot of the people who are involved in violence, particularly because it is friend and family and acquaintance violence, are afraid. And though they have plans for revenge, they are often very open to discussions of alternative responses. Often, especially teenagers, feel caught up into an escalating set of violent activities that they would like to have stopped. They just don't believe it could be stopped. So the intent of the assessment is not so much to hold people against their will, though with suicide, if you tell a physician that you are going to kill yourself before your next birthday and that you have pills at home in the bottom drawer that you're going to take at 10 o'clock tomorrow night, you probably won't get to leave the hospital.
Have you, as a physician, tried talking with a patient who is a victim of violence about their response and what they plan to do?
Yes. Often in the primary care clinic setting, which is where I see patients now, we come across patients who are participants in violence. Many have been suspended from school for violence. Some are involved in an actively escalating set of circumstances. We've been very fortunate through a grant to hire a violence prevention counselor. While we're working on protocols for physicians that need to be evaluated, and again, we are creating models of intervening that are new, so they have to be evaluated. But while we're doing that, we have a violence prevention counselor who sits down after I've done some conversation, had some conversation with the patient, and really extensively goes through the questions regarding the risk. Because this society, and I hope we'll get into some of the cultural issues as well, but because this society is not very believing of alternatives to violence, it's usually a pretty difficult conversation with patients. It's one worth having. It's one where we've had some successes. But it's not an easy conversation because we're asking that teenager to think differently than his parents, than his community, than his country, than the elected officials in the country, really than the culture really thinks about this issue.
That's really the problem in a way, because for any kind of dispute to be resolved non-violently, it kind of takes both parties to decide to not be violent. Like if somebody's out to get me and I decide I'm not going to be violent about it, well, I might just be leaving myself vulnerable.
Well, and that is a possibility. What we found, however, is that because it takes two to tango, the behavior of one can directly impact the behavior of the other. One of the things we say to kids around the issue of staying safe is, you know, don't spread rumors, don't instigate fights, don't run to see the fight. If somebody says there's a fight over here, go the other way. Now, none of those are things that are necessarily easy for kids to stop doing or to do. But once you start talking about it and they think about it, you raise some possibilities. There are ways to respond to bullies, which may not always be successful, but often are much more successful than fighting the bully. We teach kids to say things like, you know, I don't want to fight you. I don't have a problem with you. Or why are you picking on me? You know, what's wrong that you are bothering me? Or why are you trying to embarrass me? Often, you know, we call it throwing a curve in the curriculum, but often a very different, unexpected response can totally change a situation. And those are the skills that we teach kids in the classroom, but those are the skills that we as adults could have and use better.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Prothro-Stith, and she's considered the first person to frame the issue of violence as a public health issue. She's the assistant dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about violence as a public health issue. My guest, Deborah Prothro-Stith, is considered to be the first person to frame the issue of violence in such a way. She's the former state commissioner of public health in Massachusetts and now assistant dean at the Harvard School of Public Health. You know, you've actually designed a curriculum for students to teach them right. Nonviolent alternatives to anger and frustration and threats right. And challenges and so on. What age is it designed for?
Our work has been primarily with older children and young to middle teenage years, really the young teenage years. I would highlight our work with teenagers because often people think, well, that's too late or, mm-hmm. You know, you'll never change their behavior. And we've had some positive experiences.
Tell me one of those experiences.
Well, I'll tell you two. One is a story from a while ago where one of the nurse practitioners here in Boston who was teaching the curriculum had a student come back to see her really depressed. And it's a success story because he had actively avoided a fight. He had been a student in the violence prevention class she was teaching and had actively avoided a fight. He was depressed, however, and this is the not-so-successful part of the story, because his friends and associates had really not thought avoiding the fight was a good idea. So they had really been putting him down. And his parents had not thought it was a good idea either. They thought he should have fought. So while we can have some success with the skills of teenagers, we have to realize that this is a society that encourages and promotes violence. The second story that I'll tell you is a more recent one, and it was one that really surprised me. A young man who spent the summer as a violence prevention educator with the Boston City Hospital Project said about 6 weeks ago that he had been walking down the street and he was confronted by another young man, and confronted in a way that made him feel quite frightened and afraid. He said that he thought about walking away, and that the only reason he thought about it was because he had been involved in that violence prevention stuff. But the only reason he tried it, he said, was because he thought he was going to get killed anyway. So he turned and walked away, and nothing happened. He said, you know, I kept walking, and nothing happened. Later, he saw the young man on the basketball court later that afternoon, and he said that they realized that there wasn't much bad between them. In other words, there was no reason for them to fight. Now, I think that's a remarkable story because walk away is probably one of the most difficult violence prevention concepts to teach, you know, mediation, negotiation, not passing rumors, not escalating a situation. Those are easier concepts. But walk away is so un-American that it is a very, very difficult concept to teach. And this story made me start believing in walking away in a way that I hadn't before after over 15 years of working on this issue.
But don't you think the truth is a lot of people wouldn't let you walk away? A lot of people would have killed you or would have attacked you?
Well, the truth is we don't know. The truth is there's a lot of mythology about walking away, which is it's impossible to do it, that the person's going to stab you in the back, that if that person doesn't, when they see you later, they're going to get you anyway. And this story debunks a lot of those, in fact, all three of those myths. The truth is we don't know. I think that's a success story that ought to be in the newspaper because none of us believe in walking away. And now we have a violence prevention peer counselor who not only talks the talk, but has tried it. And he might even get better at it the next time because he certainly believes it now. I don't know that most people are going to stab you in the back anyway. Our whole perceptions and the mythology around violence is built on this notion that there are some stranger bad guys out there. They're just some bad people and that we have to protect ourselves against them. Again, when I learned that half of the homicides occur among friends and family and people who know each other, who get into an argument, I realize that, you know, maybe some other strategies will work.
Do you live in a neighborhood now in which there's a lot of violence?
Yes, I do. I live in Roxbury, which is a neighborhood that has the highest homicide rate in Boston, of Boston neighborhoods, and four times higher than the Boston rate. So, yes, we experience violence in our neighborhood.
Now, I know you have a couple of children. How old are they?
My daughter is 12 and my son is 15. I also have a nephew that is 23 that's lived with us for about 12 years. He's now in Atlanta. So he's not with us now.
Now, have you worked with them on the kind of issues that you're teaching in the, you know, in the schools?
Oh, definitely. I mean, one of the things that is clear to me is that as families, we've got to learn how to handle our anger. And, you know, it's a surprise that so much of the violence is family and friend violence. Yet, on the other hand, it's not a surprise because those are the people you see regularly. Those are the people who make you angry. So even the role play I've used with my kids, and that's one of the things we do in the classroom, just to help them develop the skills of relating to each other and of getting along. I also talk very openly with them about the issue of violence, how people who make movies and who sell guns make a lot of money off of this destruction, and that they need to understand that that violence isn't funny, it's not entertaining, it's not successful, that it rarely solves problems, that even when you win, you're always worried about revenge, that superheroes don't enjoy it, that that all of that's lies, that they're all telling lies, and they're making a lot of money off of it, but it's all lies.
I know that your husband is a pastor, and
yes.
I'm wondering if he has a different approach to dealing with the issue of violence when he's talking to the church, as you know, compared to your approach as a physician.
Well, we do approach it differently. His work as a minister also includes work on economic justice, which is for him a major component of the issue of violence. We know that homicide rates are higher in poor communities. We know that classism and racism are part of the problem of violence in America. And his work focuses on economic justice, economic development, economic empowerment, and those are important aspects of violence prevention. So we do approach it differently.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Deborah Prothro-Stith is an assistant dean at Harvard University School of Public Health. She's also the author of a 1991 book about teenage violence called Deadly Consequences, and she wrote the chapter on preventing violence in the textbook Health Skills for Wellness. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Say hi, drop this format, and then I'll ask why. In a way that is clever, can't you and I come together and live in harmony? The final conclusion, I'm talking about peace is the sole solution, but we can't count on humanity. I see men today are on the brink of insanity. The problems we face, we need to strengthen the mind. The hungry, the homeless, black on black crime. Equal rights, let's fight the injustice. A world that's still filled with prejudice. It's negative brothers who just don't realize we won't overcome unless we unify. Wisdom must release, ignorance must cease. Listen when I tell you, brothers, it's time for peace. It's a tragedy, no sense of consequence, the laws of gravity. What goes up must come down. Those at the top, you'll soon hit the ground. Look at history repeating itself. How many kingpins living in a prison cell? But I can't judge, this is reality. Hard times make it hard to keep morality. I once had a friend when he began. It was more like a trend, he did it now or then. But soon he took chances for larger advances.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Lessons for Life. We talk with Gloria Wade Gales about growing up in a close-knit black family where she learned to value herself and a sense of community. Her new memoir is called Pushed Back to Strength. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews George Clinton's new album. The Funk Master has come up with another catchy album title. It's called Hey Man, Smell My Finger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Department of Energy has revealed that the federal government conducted 250 more nuclear weapons tests than previously acknowledged. It also provided limited information about government tests during the 1940s and 1950s to determine the effects of radiation on humans. Today's revelations are a first step in the Energy Department's new openness program. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary said she was appalled to learn that 18 civilians had been injected with highly radioactive plutonium in the 1940s, probably without their consent. As for the nuclear test, she said the real number had not been revealed before because of concerns about the Soviet Union. With the end of the Cold War, O'Leary said her department is making an effort to come clean in every sense of that phrase. With public trust in the Department of Energy rock bottom, O'Leary understands that if she's going to work with the public, that has to change. Today, she began by declassifying hundreds of documents, part of what she says will be a long-term effort. While private research groups say the information released so far is not significant, they hailed today's move as an important first step. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The focus of world trade talks shifted to Geneva today as top U.S. and European negotiators travel there to brief officials from other countries at the offices of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. NPR's John Itzde reports.
After days of intense talks in Brussels, the United States and European Union had hoped to deliver a broad agreement to Geneva that could provide the core for a world trade deal. They fell short of the goal. Disputes over European treatment of U.S. television and films and differences over subsidies to Airbus, the European aircraft maker, remain. But they did resolve the thorny issue of farm subsidies and added that to a list of agreements in other sectors. Both U.S. and European negotiators said that progress indicates a new world trade treaty could be completed by December 15th. GATT Director General Peter Sutherland agrees.
I believe we can conclude the round, but clearly the U.S. and the European Union still have a lot to do.
December 15th is a real deadline. President Clinton's authority to send Congress a GATT treaty, which would be immune from amendments, expires at midnight on the 15th. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
The Reuters News Service is reporting that a gunman opened fire this evening on board a commuter train outside of New York City. And first reports indicate up to 15 people were wounded. Witnesses said that passengers fled the train's front cars trying to escape the gunman, who one passenger said just kept reloading his gun. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8 points to close at 3,718, a record high. This is NPR News. A judge in Los Angeles has sentenced Damian Williams to 10 years in prison for the beating of truck driver Reginald Denny in last year's riots. Williams will have at least 2 years credit for time already served and for good behavior. His attorneys had asked for probation. In giving the maximum sentence, the judge said that the court considered the crime involved great violence, and while others were beating Denny, Williams stood by and waited to strike. A co-defendant, Henry Watson, was sentenced to probation and 320 hours of community service. A Texas county has reversed an earlier decision and granted Apple Computer a tax break. Williamson County Commissioners had voted last week to deny the abatement because of the company's benefits policy for gay employees. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Apple Computer will be building a huge customer service center in Williamson County, just north of Austin, after all. The Commissioner's Court passed a compromise tax package that will grant Apple certain reimbursements on taxes in return for county right-of-way. A week ago today, they voted 3-2 against a tax abatement at a meeting marked by homophobic comments. Today, after one commissioner changed his vote, it was 3-2 in favor of Apple. A company spokesman termed the new tax package fair and equitable and said those who oppose Apple's domestic partner same-sex benefits policy are in a minority. County residents seemed relieved over the vote reversal. One man getting his hair cut at a barbershop in the town square said Williamson County had become a laughingstock around the country and the commissioners had no business meddling in Apple's affairs in the first place. In Austin, I'm John Burnett.
RJR Nabisco has announced plans to cut some 6,000 jobs. The company also says it will take an after-tax charge of $445 million in the fourth quarter. The job cuts will occur throughout the company, administrative, sales, distribution, and operations. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. To better understand the state of African-American families today, Gloria Waite Gales looked back on her own family in the 1940s and 50s. Her new memoir, Pushed Back to Strength, is about growing up in the segregated South and later joining the Civil Rights Movement. Waite Gales is a professor of English at Spelman College and author of No Crystal Stair, a study of race and sex in black women's novels. The title of her memoir, Pushed Back to Strength, comes from something her grandmother used to tell her.
It comes from my rememberings of my years growing up in Memphis, Tennessee, in a segregated housing project. I would complain to my grandmother about all of the signs that were pushing us to the back of buses and pushing us to the back of theaters. And I would say to her, I'm just so angry because they're pushing us back to the housing project. And my grandmother would nod in agreement and without looking up from what she was doing. She would say, mm-hmm, yes. But white people don't really know what they're doing. What they're doing is pushing you back to us, where you can get some strength, get strong. And that was the inspiration for the title of the book.
You say in your book that African Americans of your grandmother's generation had no illusions about their lack of power, but they really believed in their strength.
Yes, they did. And for them, strength was the community. And that is why my grandmother said we were being pushed back to strength, total immersion in a black community where the sounds in the community were affirming sounds. There was never a time in my upbringing that I did not know that I was adorned and that I was loved and that I was supposed to do something special with my life, grow beyond the confines of the housing project.
You were very angry about segregation growing up in the South.
Oh,
you grew
yes.
up in a housing project. You went to segregated schools. But now you think that integration didn't bring what it was promised to bring.
No, it did not. One of the problems, of course, with integration is that black people in communities like mine, black people all across the nation, really carried to a great extent the responsibility of making the changes that we now call integration. Black parents were the parents who woke their children at 6 a.m. and put them on buses that went for 45 minutes to other sides of the city, to white schools. And when we did that, we abandoned our neighborhood schools. And the result has been a tremendous change. The schools now are not like the schools in which I was educated. So integration did push, and I keep using that word for a reason, integration pushed a number of us into, pushed us toward the mainstream, toward the center. But the masses of black people are still marginalized.
Now, you grew up in what some would consider a broken family because your parents were divorced, and while you were growing up in Memphis, your father lived in Chicago. But you had a big and very supportive family in Memphis, a mother, a grandmother, an aunt, three uncles, a sister. You say your mother was the brains of the family. She believed in education. How did she encourage you?
Yes, I call my mother the intellectual without a degree. she encouraged us, and so did my grandmother, by going to the library with us, by keeping books in the house, by engaging in polemics, by reading books herself, by stressing education. Everything in our lives revolved around education. I write in the book that my mother had a single eye, and in that eye was the achievement of her girls, her precious girls, she called us, my sister and me. So education was very important.
Your grandmother was the fighter. What did she instill?
Oh, she was the feisty one. And I believe that my involvement in the civil rights movement came as a result of my identifying with my grandmother. She simply refused to accept no when she went downtown, when she interacted with white people. She had a way of claiming her own space as a woman who happened to be black, but who refused to let her blackness lock her out. She was very, very defiant, feisty.
My guest is Gloria Wade Gales, and she's written a new memoir called Push Back to Strength. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Gloria Wade Gales is my guest. She teaches at Spelman College and has written a memoir called Push Back to Strength, A Black Woman's Journey Home. In 1959, you won a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship to study at Boston University, and that brought you to the North for the first time. And it was in the North that you became involved with the civil rights movement. I'm sure that had something to do with the times as well as the changes you were going through.
Yes.
But did your view of being black change when you went to the North?
Not my view of being black.
Your view of race relations in America, let me put it that way.
Yes. What I learned from my experiences in Boston was what I already knew, and that was that racism was not a regional problem. It was not a Southern problem. It was a national problem. What I learned about myself as a black woman was that I was more interested in trying to educate whites, become a part of white culture, assimilate, integrate, than I was in working with black people in black neighborhoods. And I write about that in the book. If I had it to do differently, if I had it to do it again, I would be more connected with the black community in Roxbury.
How many years have you been teaching at Spelman now?
I've been teaching at Spelman for 10 years. 10 wonderful years.
Have your students' situations changed in those 10 years? Do the problems and obstacles that they face as young people coming of age, nearing the time where they have to find a job and all of that, has that changed?
Yes, it has changed. I think one of the current concerns that students today have is, what professional choices should I make that will not disconnect me spiritually from my who-ness and yet give me an opportunity to realize my talents and to use them? So there's that struggle to be a part of corporate America and yet to be connected to home. It's an ongoing struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask you about your mother. Your mother died a few years ago, and as she was nearing her death, she seemed to know what was happening to her, and she tried to tell you that she was dying, and you didn't know how to interpret that?
I didn't want to accept.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what she was saying, but I didn't want to accept that she had seen her own death and was preparing me to let her go.
What did she tell you that made you realize that she knew that it was imminent?
She gave me all of her insurance cards. a list of her medicines, and she said to me, as if she knew she was going to die the very next day, when I leave, or when I become ill, or when you take me to the hospital, do not let them, meaning doctors, of course, put me on life support systems. And my response was, oh, mother, there you go again, going to the other world, because she talked of the world of the spirit. And she said, no, you listen to me. Do not let them, after my death, perform an autopsy, because the cause of my death will be that it was my time to go. She was very insistent. I resisted. She said, no, you listen to me. Put these cards into your purse. And remember, you have to let me go. You must let me go.
How did you feel when she told you never to put her on life support systems? It's such a difficult decision to make. Would you have felt completely comfortable in following her advice?
I think I would have. Yes, I would have had to follow her orders. Those were orders. But I'm blessed that I didn't have to make a decision whether to follow her orders or not. She died suddenly of a massive heart attack.
So have you always wondered what it was that she knew or how she knew?
She was connected to the spirit. I write in the book about many conversations my mother had about the spiritual world. And when I would say, oh, there you go, talking about that world, she would say, just keep living and you will learn from your experiences that a spiritual dimension does in fact exist. She was connected to that world. She had, in a sense, seen her own death, had embraced it, had accepted it, and wanted me to do so as well.
Did that help you accept it?
At first, yes. Months later, however, the finality of death, of her death, caused me consummate grief. I have worked through my grief, and in working through my grief, in being healed, I have, in fact, come to understand the power of that spiritual dimension. Understanding that has helped me be connected to my mother in a way that I was not connected when she was physically on this earth. She's with me every moment. She's with me now in the studio. I know that.
I just have one last question for you. In preparing your memoir, Push Back the Strength, did you go back to your old neighborhood in Memphis where you grew up, to the housing project, to the main street, to see what it was like?
No, I did not. I must explain that I had no intentions of writing this book. I was actually writing a scholarly study of Alice Walker's novels. My research was going well. I was at Harvard at the time, a semester away from Spelman. And then one day I turned on the television and there was Anita Hill and there was Clarence Thomas. And I felt moved to write my response to that experience. I began working on an essay, A Black Woman's Response to Anita Hill Clarence Thomas Hearings. And in order to write that essay, I called on my mother and my father and my grandmother and others in my experiences who were in eternity. I called on them to help me write that essay. When I finished the essay, I said to myself, okay, I can return to the scholarship. And I said to the spirits, you can go back to eternity and watch over me from there. But they wouldn't leave. Really, they wouldn't leave. And I realized that what I had to do was take a journey home because I was in need of healing. I needed something that would help me process that experience, that would help me process the experience of seeing homeless people every day on my way from Boston to Harvard, that would help me process what was happening to Black communities in this nation. And that's why I wrote the book.
Do you feel that you understand the new communities, the communities that don't have the kind of strong family that you had, that don't have the sense of strength in themselves that your family had. Do you feel you understand it?
I understand their pain. I understand their tragedy. I am an outsider, however, and I wouldn't want to give any prescriptions for them or even say that I understand exactly what they are experiencing. I am an outsider because I do not live in those communities. But I understand that they are under siege. I understand that there's crippling unemployment, there's violence, there's the drug community, there's pain. In that sense, I understand those communities and that the tremendous need we have as a nation to address the tragedy.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me here to share my rememberings.
Gloria Wade-Gales is a professor of English at Spelman College. Her new memoir is called Pushed Back to Strength. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We'll be hearing today about the U.S. Department of Energy making public certain details about nuclear fusion that actually relate to weapons production. It's a post-Cold War disclosure of technology that had been kept secret until now. We'll also be hearing about some people's concern about pro-imperial behavior on the part of Russia, in particular the Russian army. And Maria Hinojosa reports from Puerto Rico about unusual efforts there to stop crime. And they've called out the National Guard.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the past 30 years, George Clinton has created enormously influential funk music, first as the leader of Parliament Funkadelic, a large band that combined rhythm and blues with hard rock, then as a solo artist whose 1982 hit Atomic Dog has made him a major influence on today's rap and hip-hop acts. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that Clinton's new album called Hey Man, Smell My Finger reaffirms Clinton's artistic vitality in the 90s.
San Diego Freeway northbound. I'm gonna look, I won't touch. Oh, it's live, but didn't think very much. Where they happen to be at tonight is Hollywood.
At the age of 52, George Clinton is the best argument I know to refute the notion that rock music is a young person's game. His combinations of James Brown's elemental funk and acid rock's heedless improvisations, the way Clinton crams stream-of-consciousness jokes, puns, and philosophy into tight, finger-popping melodies, make his music seem endlessly fresh. Every time you listen to his best stuff, there's always something new to catch. In a recent interview, Clinton theorized that his ongoing influence is due to the fact that, quote, it just takes so long for people to understand or get it, and generation after generation gets it. On his new release, a thick, rich track like Martial Law is a good example of what Clinton means.
It's gonna take more!
Martial Law features cameos by hot rap performers like Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, whom Clinton shamelessly uses to give himself some trendy youth credibility. But the lyrics of that song are unusual in a couple of ways. As it proceeds, Clinton starts talking about news events like the beating of Rodney King and the LA riots, Clinton rarely invokes current events like this, which can date what he always conceives of as timeless, fad-proof music. What's also unusual is that, unlike the rappers who admire and perform with him, he's on Rodney King's side. He really does want us all to get along. Clinton's politics were forged in the 60s in Detroit, when he used to hold down a songwriting job with Motown Records by day, and then go and drop acid at concerts by the MC5 or Iron Butterfly at night. In matters both musical and cultural, Clinton remains a very credible integrationist. In his more standard mode, Clinton aims for music he calls seriously silly, stuff that's light and playful on the surface, but with intricately structured rhythms and harmonies that give a composition musical weight. Consider a groove like Way Up, in which Clinton himself is barely heard, but instead functions as a conductor for a very simple but grandly decorated funk riff. Really, the worst I can say about Hey Man, Smell My Finger is that I don't particularly care for that off-putting title. Since George remains the unimpeachable president of funk, I'd have preferred something more seriously silly. I think he should have called this collection Clinton, Still in Office.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reef are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and novelist Roddy Doyle. He adapted his novel, The Commitments, into a hit film about a Dublin band that plays soul music. His new movie, The Snapper, directed by Stephen Frears, is a comedy about a teenager who gets pregnant and won't tell anybody who the father is. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.